Word to the Wise. We are an explicit podcast tackling content with adult themes as well as entering spoiler territory if you aren't caught up with us. That would be the same as last week, through all of The Heroes by Joe Abercrombie. Plus a little bit of talk about Dark Age, probably.
We're going to keep that in its own little spoiler section, though, so don't worry if you haven't read Dark Age. We're going to keep that near the end, I promise.
Okay.
Hey there, this is Cross.
I'm PJ.
And we are Words in Whiskey, a podcast for veteran and novice readers alike. We tackle fiction novels and love to talk about what we're drinking. You should think of us as your intoxicating weekly book club.
You, dear listener, probably heard Crossland say the word three a couple times.
I'm going to cut those. You fucker. Trying to sell me out.
I kept cutting him off when he was trying to transition.
Yeah. Well, I don't have anything important that I have to wake up for in the morning, but you have a baby and child and I'm trying to be responsible with your time. So
yeah,
fair enough. But yeah, today, like PJ mentioned at the very top of the episode, so gracefully and graciously for us, is our final episode in which we'll be talking about The Heroes on the whole. This is our wrap-up episode for The Heroes. I'm very excited for this conversation. Unfortunately, Ben wasn't able to make it. He fell ill. It was a terrible turn, in part because like, our schedule has also become so tight. Yeah, dysentery for sure. But our schedule has become so tight in that
I'm sorry,
it's
Ben.
Also difficult for us to schedule. But he also was super busy over the next couple of weeks. So Ben will come back. It'll be a lot of fun at some point in the future. But so we're just knocking this one out ourselves.
Hope comes back. If he survives dysentery, we're rooting for him.
Oh my God. Cool.
Do people still get dysentery?
I would assume.
Is that an illness of the past?
Like a solved disease. I mean, it's not entirely solved. It's mostly
a lack of nutrition.
So like you could mess up what you're eating and like it's an inflammatory thing that can also be caused by other components. But my understanding is that dysentery is made more likely based on like food safety things. So,
right.
You know,
okay.
Proximity to molds and other things like that. Poor sanitation. Mm. So, yeah.
Well,
we just got done recording an hour and a half episode talking about the first three episodes of Pantheon Season 1, which is going to be available on our Patreon as a devil's cut. We did not intend for it to go that long, but here we are. We have had a beer and a shot, so we aren't drunk, but we are having a good time. With that, before we fully get into what we are, or what we're going to talk about, which is The Heroes, PJ, what cocktail did you craft for this evening?
I crafted an imagining of what a margarita would be in the Union. So, Crossland and I decided last time we did themed cocktails, I did a northern cocktail. Crossland did a Union cocktail. He did something with gin. I wanted to do something different, so I did something with tequila. But I also did something.
Ooh,
I had this weird like parallel thought to like an existing cocktail, an existing take on a margarita, which was serendipitous, but it worked out pretty well. So if you look up, I think they called it a Spanish margarita, but it's a margarita with liquor 43, which is like a Spanish vanilla liquor. But I also added green chartreuse because I thought like vanilla and herbal and tequila could be really good together. So
yeah,
the way that I put this together was 1.5 ounces of Blanco tequila. I used Terramana. 1.5 ounces of liquor 43, which is like this sweet vanilla forward. It goes really well with rum. I always think of it as rum adjacent. That's not really what it is, but that's like where it lives in my brain.
It's like an agricole.
Yeah.
Kind of.
1/2 ounce of green chartreuse, which is probably too much, but I haven't tasted it yet, so I don't know that for sure. 1/4 ounce is probably fine, but went with 1/2. And then 2 dashes of orange bitters and the juice of 1 lime, which I think probably came out to about 3/4 ounce.
Okay. That's pretty typical.
Yeah. Yeah. Worked out pretty well. I didn't add any sugar because both Liquor 43 and Green Chartreuse are fairly sweet. Mm-hmm. So I shook this cocktail 2 hours ago. I have no idea if it's still cold, but I'll taste it right now.
I thought I had poured absinthe into my atomizer and I wanted to put a little bit on top of my cocktail and I haven't done it yet. How was it?
Delicious.
Nice.
Not cold, but fine. Man, that green chartreuse with the lime really works with the, like, all of it works really well. I'm really proud of this. Yummy, yummy. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
It's such a smart spin. I'm really intrigued by that whole idea. What are you following it up with?
Following that,
what do you call it, by the way? What are you calling it?
Oh, that's a good question. We can workshop this a little bit. The whole idea was like a union margarita, but
let me tell you what I was going to do just from an idea perspective. I forgot that we had flipped intentionally where I was doing the north. So my first instinct when I went to my liquor shelf was, what's in Tunney's flask? And that ended up being the accidental base of this, and I corrected to make it a northern drink. So okay. I would say that that's Tunney's flask, right?
So by the picture that you sent me, we both went kind of tropical. If a margarita counts as tropical.
This is not tropical.
Interesting. You just served it in a tiki head mug.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I wanted a visual.
Yeah, but that's fair.
It's this is much more orchardy than you would think. It is rum, but it's orchardy.
Okay. If margaritas are the cocktail of Mexico.
Sure.
What is the Mexico equivalent of the union? Like,
I feel like we've already used this name, unfortunately, but I was like, it could be like a Degoskin sunrise, right? Or it could be like a Westport sling.
Ooh, okay.
Like the cities that are external. I know that we're talking Italy. You know, and like Morocco, you know.
I feel like there's another country that doesn't get a lot of, or I don't know if it's country or region or something that is.
I mean, there's England, right?
There's England, but this isn't Englandish. It starts with an S, but it's not.
I mean, there's Styria, of course, but
not Styria. There's a different.
Oh, are you thinking about? Hang on, the Suljuk, right? Where
yes,
our boy is from.
Yeah. Where Brother Longfoot is from.
Yes,
but Suljuk doesn't have a good. That doesn't roll off the tongue that well when. But Suljuk sling does.
Yeah.
All right. We'll go with the Suljuk sling.
All right. I love it. Okay. I love it. That fits for me. What's your back half?
Back half is, I think I might have had it on the show before, but I just went back to Luplin, met some neighbors there, and I picked up another 4-pack of the Double Stuffed Sandwich Cookie Imperial Stout.
Oh, yum. That looks good.
It is really
cool.
Oreo stout. So, without saying the word Oreo. Crossland, what are you drinking? We alluded
PJ, a little bit. I made an abomination per my name and like kind of pouring this. I poured aggressively. It is so tasty. This is delightful. I just mean like as I read out these ingredients, you're not going to be impressed or pleased with the ideas at all. Because again, I started building what I thought was going to be Tony's flask and then it became not that.
Fair enough.
So I started with, I'll do 2 ounces of Smith and Cross. Heavy.
I almost did Smith and Cross for mine also.
Yeah.
So because I thought Navy strength rum. I thought maybe like, yeah.
Exactly. For the union. That was my thought. I was like, Tunney's flask. Perfect. And then I dropped in right after that. I was like, if I'm doing one rum, generally you want to do two and you want to try to mix, especially mixing down a super powerful rum like that. So I did Plantation, the last of my Plantation 5-year. I did 1.5 ounces of that. And then I went, shit, wait a minute. Yeah.
just wait. You're at 3.5 ounces of rum, two of which are high proof.
Then I went, I need some sort of like diluting, you know, like central liqueur, right? So I was like,
diluting liqueur.
It should probably, we're dialing it down over the course of the volume of the drink. There's a shit ton of ice in this. And I added 1/2 ounce of Saint Germain.
Okay.
And 1/2 ounce of maraschino. Then I went, this is not supposed to be a Union drink. This is supposed to be a Northman drink. Because like Saint Germain feels like very refined in a Union palate.
Tunney's way, and sort stolen of like, flask.
Yeah. Yeah. And so what I added for the rest of it was my pear orchard syrup, specifically because okay. of the pear apple orchard cinnamon syrup. And then I also obviously added an ounce of lemon juice and the... and an ounce of pear juice as well. So those were sort of what I shook. Ounce of pear, ounce of lemon, all of that liquor slurry. And then, you know, shook it, served it in a cocktail glass, had a bunch of ice in it. It's been an hour and a half since this was poured. So all of the ice is gone. It's still cold. And then I poured overproof. And by overproof, I mean just more Smith and Cross on top.
That is a lot. That's a lot.
Death by Orchard.
Death by Orchard. All right.
Yeah. Yeah. Just to give it the name of the orchard, of course, that is so, you know, notable throughout a lot of this, but
yeah.
Or the Drowned Orchard. Yeah, the Drowned Orchard. That's what we're going with. Because it does sounds vaguely good. Have tiki vibes and it feels kind of tiki-ish. But it is delightful. The other side of this is so good. I did want to add, I ran off while you were explaining your cocktail for just a second to grab my new atomizer that I got that I thought I filled with absinthe. But I didn't. And a spray of absinthe on the top of this or on the inside of the glass would have been the only modification I would have made.
That's a beautiful atomizer, by the way.
It's a Visky atomizer. And I was at a grocery store the other day and it was just on the shelf there. And I was like, what? Okay. I love Visky stuff. And so it matches the rest of my stuff too. So I was like, perfect.
Nice. Speaking of Visky.
Mm-hmm. This is also a Visky tiki glass, by the way.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah.
Looks really good.
For all the people listening.
Yeah.
You can totally see that really cool tiki glass.
Show that Kaylin and I have started, because once in a while, the baby sleeps for like 3 hours at a time, and we just get to like catch up on all our shows and stuff. Mm-hmm. Specifically, that happened this weekend on Sunday. She slept for like 3 hours and we caught up on The Last of Us and Handmaid's Tale. And then we watched a couple episodes of Your Friends and Neighbors.
Hmm. Oh, yeah. The Apple show.
Yeah, it's on Apple. Almost exclusively, they use the same
glassware,
like Visky glassware that I have.
This shit's gorgeous, man.
It's really pretty, and like it's not like it looks really nice on camera. It just looks really classy, but it's not like it doesn't detract from anything. Like it doesn't draw attention away from anything. Yeah. Like it just works perfectly. Anytime I see that glassware or any Visky glassware on any show, I always point it out because it's like.
That's ours.
We're noticeable.
Those.
Yeah. That's ours. Those are our glasses. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
No. Yeah. I'm
the heroes. You.
Yeah. I want to make mention of, my back half beer is a beer that I've had before on the show, but I haven't had in a while. It's Lightning Drops by Resident Culture. It's just a straight IPA. Very tasty, very good, pretty local. So nice. good little company. On our episode in which we talked about Pantheon, I had a beer from a brewery up in Raleigh because I was in Raleigh doing a barbecue thing yesterday again, meeting with Logan, the longtime guest of the show, multiple times, hung out with him and my brother and ate just a fuck ton of barbecue. So
dude, I'm so jealous.
I brought one of the beers back and then had that. So
awesome.
Yeah, it was an incredible day on the whole. So yeah, with that, if you're looking for Visky glassware, might I recommend that you add the code to check out How to Drink. It's Greg from How to Drinks code for a discount. We don't have one, but you should absolutely use his code to get yourself a discount. So you there heard you it go. Here first. We're pumping his
heard
stuff.
It, heard it here second.
Just because we talked so much about Visky, I feel like it's necessary to promote a discount code if you're chasing that down.
Yep.
But okay, The Heroes. I'm super excited to kind of talk about this and kind of get into the wrap up here. First off, let's start with, you know, your general overall thoughts. How did you feel about The Heroes as an entry in the Joe Abercrombie books?
I think it's my favorite book of his.
Mm-hmm.
So far of what I've read so far, I think it's my favorite. There's so many different feelings from all of the different perspectives, but also like all of the different characters outside of those perspectives, like the little tangential things we get from the Dog Man. It is such a heavy book and feels so real, very low magic, but just enough to let you know that it's still here. Mm-hmm. It's still playing roles. Man, it's depressing a lot of the times.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with you. I think that the heroes, and I mean agree with you in the way that it's depressing all the times. I think it ranks pretty highly in my estimation. Although, again, I said this about Red Rising recently in a different conversation. There's no book that's worse than a B. I think this one is like an 8.5 out of 10 for me. I really deeply like it, but I do feel like one of the things that this is missing versus some of the other books is just a little bit more time because of how divided the perspectives are. Because we're hopping from 6 different heads over the course of 540 pages or what have you, I do feel like, with the exception of the 3 guys that we talked about, almost no one else gets enough time. And even they need a little bit more time to breathe from moment to moment. Like, we talked about this when we were going through, but the death of so much of Craw's crew, right? Of Agric, of Agrok, like the Athrok and Agric, and then also Brak, right?
Yeah.
The only one that I think hits emotionally is Droft, you know, when he dies, and Wirin, when the two of them die during the final battle, because we've had enough time with them to kind of build it up. And like, losing one right away would have been fine, but I think it's just things like that to me that, like,
yeah,
the story does well and plays well in its own beats, but I need a little bit more time for all those things to mean something.
So my take on that is that we didn't need to know those characters, and those characters' deaths didn't need to hit us, or at least for me. Mm-hmm. Those characters' deaths didn't need to hit me super hard. I just needed to know that it was weighing on Craw. And Craw, right, was never relieved from the feeling of, I just lost another one, the entire time.
Yeah. Yeah. It ends up becoming an indictment, you know, on war through especially Craw's lens. He's the one of whom, you know, very much has that sort of perspective, and Beck, but mostly through, mm-hmm, Craw's. So, yeah.
Yeah. That was my take on that sort of aspect of things. Because to a certain degree, yes, I agree with you that, like, we didn't get a lot from them. But it was also, those characters were never meant to be built that way. Mm-hmm. The whole point was for us to experience death after death after death after death from Craw's perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It definitely is, like, and I think that weight is so important. And then in the end, though, with Craw, like, sort of there is this reflection where he can't give it up either, because he's not good at anything else. So, like, he's so invested at that point that it does feel like we're indicting the losses and everything else, but simultaneously, he can't give it up. So there's like a bitter irony, I think, to me.
Can't get,
you know, it, like, there.
That end with Craw was hard to really nail down, because it's one thing to claim that he can't give it up, and that's certainly a fair read on it. But the other side of that argument is that it's the only thing he's actually good at. And the one thing that he thought he could go back to, he has proven to himself to be shit at.
Yeah.
And there is the monotony and the cooped up sort of feeling that he has in this little house that he's built for himself, mm-hmm, poorly.
Yeah.
But
his bunk bed.
But I think the main thing is that he's just not good at the one thing he thought he could go back to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a spur of the moment decision, I think. Like, I really think that sort of last line of, Like, I think that that was the truth of his thought process of like, this life that I know I'm actually pretty good at is still open to me. Mm-hmm. Maybe I need to take it before I kill someone with my bad chairs.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair. I get it. I do get it. And I understand it from a character perspective. I can't help but personally feel like if I was in the same situation that I would take the out. I mean, I would take the being bad as a chair maker. I would take, and like, that's me, not Kraw as a character. But I think as Kraw sort of our insert as a veteran of war and everything else, like the appeal of not losing anyone else to me outweighs the,
yeah,
you know, the other side. Although I'll give Kraw this credit. It is effectively his son that is calling for him to come back. It's a little different, even though they're, you know, obviously kind of estranged, but because it's Calder, it's a little different.
Yeah, I don't think he would have gone back if it was Dow
seeking Golden, you know.
Or anyone else. But at the same time, I don't think that Hardbread would have been the one knocking on his door if it was anybody other than Calder either.
Really interesting. I guess the reason that Hardbread is so interesting to me as a character because he is on the Dogman side, right? And then the Dogman obviously retires to Ufrith, puts down the sword, which is what I'm kind of reflecting on the end here for a moment because that's where we're at. But so Dogman puts down the sword, actually tries to plant and grow things, which is what Logan said, you know, in the end of like what they should try to achieve and strive for, having taken over Ufrith and sort of the protectorate therein. And so Hardbread rejoined Calder because he's no Black Dow, wants to fight for the North, wants to fight for sort of uniting these people in groups to some degree. So
if that was somebody other than Calder,
yeah,
would Hardbread do it?
Yeah. I think Hardbread would. I don't think Kraw would. That's what
that's for sure.
I think Hardbread would. Yeah. I think Hardbread doesn't really give a shit though. Like he cares morally, you know, to some degree about like the right side of things. He's a straight edge, as Kraw says almost right off the bat in the book, which is again sort of the same thing that's said back to him many times over the course of the novel.
I had forgotten that he said that to Hardbread.
If he didn't say that he was a straight edge, it was something very adjacent and it's like mirrored, but I think he called him a straight edge. If not a straight edge, a hard edge, but
okay. It's repeated so often I'd believe it if that was the first place that came up.
I've drained this cocktail. It is so goddamn good.
Crosslands, there is so much booze in that cocktail.
We'll see you tomorrow, folks. Ah. Oh man. No, I'm it's really tasty. As I'm getting to the bottom, it's actually more water. So now I'm like, oh, I drank most of the booze. Eep. Okay. So I love Kraw as a character. Kraw, I think, is my favorite point of view in the novel. I don't think it's particularly close.
Yeah. I think Beck is a close second for me.
Beck is really good. I would agree.
Yeah. But Kraw is for sure first.
Yeah. Why do you put Beck in a close second?
It's just so unique to this series. Mm-hmm. It's the farm boy. And that's the ironic thing is that it feels like such a, but it's done so cleanly.
You don't even sense it as a trope. I brought it up because I want to analyze these things.
I feel like it's fairly easy to sense as a trope of the literal farm boy.
I actually didn't, in my initial read, I did not clock that intentionally, I would say. It was just like, oh, he's another Northman that wants to join up. Okay. It's a natural thing to want to do as a kid. But then I like took it in and I was like, oh, he's like a farm boy with like a father and a legacy. Like this is Luke Skywalker in some regard. You know?
Yeah, exactly. So like, and the completeness of his character arc. He's experienced hardship and he's experienced tragedy, but he gets out so cleanly when nobody else does the entire series. Nobody gets out cleanly like he does.
He's the only character who kind of gets a happy ending.
I'm going to hold to my claim from last week or 2 weeks ago, whenever the last episode came out.
We put Dungeon Crawler Carl out last week.
Yeah. That him not taking the money makes him not a professional soldier. And that's the reason he's able to get out as cleanly as he does. Like,
sure,
morally that is the physical embodiment of his morals.
Mm-hmm.
He's not selling those out in a literal way. Yeah, I really liked Beck's whole arc from start to finish in the week that we live with him.
Which is crazy, because if you recall, you disliked Beck a lot upon first blush.
I believe that. I disliked Finry more.
You did. But you were like, I don't really like Beck. I definitely don't like Finry.
Yeah.
Yeah. As she got introduced in part two. Yeah.
Mm. And she came around for me too. So.
Yeah, I would say Finry ends up being the character that benefits. We've talked about this a little bit, but Finry and Beck both benefit so much from the end of the story informing the rest of like their intention, or like the intention of those characters as reflections upon the sort of different ways in which war impacts people. My God, the sweet cocktail has attracted one fucking fruit fly, and I'm going to murder this anyway. Yeah, so it's just this interesting beat in and amongst the story for each of them, as we kind of, we almost get, you know, blinders and rear view glasses going as we proceed through the story for those characters.
Yeah. I think early on, after that first episode came out, or second, whatever, our first episode with Finry,
which is our third episode. Yep.
Is it the third episode? Whatever it is.
Because she's not introduced until part three or part two. So.
I hadn't clocked this myself, but it made a lot of sense when I saw Ivana post that.
One of our patrons. Thank you, Ivana.
Of course. That Alrianne from the Mistborn series fills a similar, not role, but is in a similar
vibe.
Similar vibe, especially at the beginning of the story, and like, it makes sense that I didn't like her for the same reasons. And Finry has a better arc than Alrianne does.
Oh, for sure. It's not even close.
Yeah, not even close.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like where Alrianne goes quite a bit, for the record. But I've been on the record saying that, obviously. But yeah, Finry is so interesting from a character perspective. I think I mentioned this in the last episode, and if I didn't, I intended to, but the immediate comparison that I have as I think about her character is immediately I bring it back to Ardy, right? And sort of the comparisons that they have as inversions of each other, and like how well they pair that way as analyses on the state of society in the Union and the place that women occupy within it.
Yeah.
Versus Styria, even as we saw like Monza and everything else. But
there, I don't know what it is. There is still just something in my head. And I know the age doesn't line up with this, but for whatever reason, I imagine Ardy as so much more mature than Finry.
And I do think that she is more mature. I can't
break that.
No, but I agree with you. I do think, like we said, the ages are different. I do think that Finry Danbrock is a little bit older than Ardy is, but I do think that Ardy is more mature. It's because of the nature of the life that she lived. I mean, the reality of like her situation is so much more dire. I mean, from like being a lowborn person in family to like having Westrise, and to like the abuse suffered as a child, and then to see that contrasted against, you know, Finry's situation, in which she is incredibly well educated. She's intelligent. She's strategic. She has all of the like makings in so many ways of a general, and instead turns into a politician because that's the best that she could maybe aspire to because of societal bounds. You know, it's an interesting spot to be in. So I think that makes them interesting foils as characters.
Yeah.
Do you think they'll see each other in the future? Do you think they'll interact? Do you think we'll see any of these characters in the future? First off, outside of Shivers.
Presumably, Artie is still married to Glockta.
Yep.
And I think Glockta will brush against Hera Denbrock. And I think Artie and Finry will cross paths as a result of that.
Okay. Cool.
Just yes.
Just curious. Yeah. Yeah. It'll
not that Glockta really brings his work home that often, but
no. And I think especially Glockta is pretty good at that. And you know, I don't know. Hal Herod doesn't seem like he's that kind of man to, you know, really be a problem. It would be Finry pushing too hard that would lead for him to be a problem.
His parentage is a problem. So
yeah,
I think there's going to be some scrutiny to make sure. Like, I agree with you. I don't think he will be a problem, but I think there's going to be some vetting that happens.
Sure. Yeah. Fair. Fair and valid. Cool. So we circled into some characters here, and we'll circle back to them in a moment here to talk about some of the other ones. But I wanted to bring up this thought that we were exploring quite a bit throughout the course of the podcast. But the fact that this is these are standalones, right? Pierce Brown recommends, according to Leanna, that people start here, right? This is, in many ways, I think, the clearest sequel to The Last Argument of Kings.
Yeah, I'd agree.
How do you feel about sort of the idea of reading these, now that you've read 2.5, we'll talk about that half later, of these out of, you know, in sequence, how do you feel about the idea of assessing the standalones as standalones?
I think about this all the time when I'm reading these.
Me too. I thought about this a lot. I don't know, dude.
I think I see it.
Really?
I think I see it with
Best of Cold way more than I do the heroes.
No, Best for some reason
it feels so much more contained to me.
It does feel more contained, but I don't think Best of Cold, so looking at it from the perspective of, like, why would you recommend this book first? Because I think this book shows what the rest of the series is all about better than Best of Cold does.
Really? I don't... Okay. I
think Best of Cold is a... It's amazing. I love it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's disconnected and also different from... Like, it is more different from the other books in the series. Like, this has more connected DNA while still being standalone.
Yeah. Okay. I understand. Let me draw my comparison and then we'll talk about this more. Okay. I like that analysis. I think that logically makes sense to me. My point of disagreement is I feel like what Best of Cold does so well is that it proves that Joe can tell a story and also, like, end a story very efficiently, which then makes sense for you to go back to The Blade itself and to go back to all these other books. Wherein I think The Heroes leans a lot more, in my opinion, in its emotionality and payoff, on some of the other things that are almost like a little bit more tangential in storytelling. Like, it leans on your knowledge of the difference between the North and the Union. It leans on expectations of Baez and, like, the importance and weight of Baez showing up. You might get that menace still. There are just so many different layers that I think are so much better if you've read the rest of the series versus otherwise. I think that this is maybe like a pretty good 8 out of 10 with some, like, brutal moments for someone versus, like, the series is a 9.5 out of 10, you know, but The Blade itself takes time.
Yeah. So I think I agree with you totally.
That's my struggle.
Like, yeah. I don't disagree with you in any way.
I would never recommend someone start on Red Country. Ever. Zero. Anyway, that's a separate.
We also fair about that. I've already read half of it.
Yeah.
But I think I'm taking this as like, I'm not allowed to just say start with the blade itself. Like, if
let's talk about this in a real context. Ben bounced off of the blade itself. He gave it 150 pages. He's tried four times to read it.
Yeah.
To someone whom can't get through it. Do you recommend The Heroes or do you recommend Best of Cold? I passionately feel like Best of Cold is the solution there.
For Ben, I think it's Best of Cold.
You know what I mean?
I guess that's the trouble.
Both of these are good recommends, like, for the record. But
I guess what I'm saying is I understand Pierce Brown's supposed point of view on it.
By the way, Ben, Hallerpod Ben, not overly average Ben. Overly average has read the whole series. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Ben has not made it through the first book.
Yeah. I guess my whole point is I get his point of view because this feels like a good segue straight into the initial trilogy.
In an inverse Rogue One-y way, you know?
If you like, don't think the person would be willing to just jump right into the trilogy,
mm-hmm.
this feels like a good starting point to get them to immediately want to read the prequel to it.
A sidestep, for sure. Yeah. Yeah, okay. I can give you that. I think my edge still goes to Best of Cold because I think that it does do a more cohesive job of like an isolated story that doesn't require anything else. But I can see the value in The Heroes from the angle also of like, I think The Heroes nails theme in a way that Best of Cold also does, but for a different audience that I think is maybe more universal. A lot of people that love revenge tales will love revenge tales. They'll like that.
Mm-hmm.
But The Heroes nails also like kind of a political point and an ethical point and a moral point with all the different characters. So,
yeah,
I can see that working too.
That said,
and also
I've only ever recommended the whole trilogy. I've got my father-in-law reading The Blade itself right now, and he is
cool,
loving it.
That's good.
He's expressed wanting to get back into reading. At one point, he read through all of the Game of Thrones series, and
he loves Game of Thrones. This is like
he keeps talking about. He's like this is so much like Game of Thrones. I love it so much. So
it has the same addictive qualities, and obviously because Joe was so directly inspired. But
exactly,
yeah, yeah. It's great, and it knocks it out of the park in that way. So that's encouraging to hear. And yeah, on the other side, it's always like it is a tough sell for people. I recommended, you know, a friend of whom didn't want to start the trilogy to start on Best of Cold, and she bounced off of it so hard. And it was like, oh, the series also isn't for you, you know, at that point versus like committing to the rest of it. So it's also understandable.
Do you think she would have like accepted The Heroes?
No, The Heroes would have been the opposite in that case. Yeah. I think that would have been a harder no. In a rogue take here, I think she probably out of the standalones would have been the best with Red Country, because I think we'll get into that when we talk about Red Country. I'm not going to talk about it right now. For people who are listening to this, we are recording this and PJ has already started reading Red Country because we have to. That's the way that things work. So we're not going to talk about Red Country at all, but just need to make it clear that there's other knowledge in the back burner here for once that we don't usually do.
Right.
Although not that much. It's tangential. Like there's nothing, you know,
I think Shivers.
That's really the only thing.
And Shivers has showed up.
Once, twice?
Once for sure. I don't know if twice.
Yeah.
Maybe twice, but twice and close together. I can't remember.
Yeah. Best Man is a long chapter. We'll get into that in a bit. That'll be next week on the podcast. But yeah. Okay, cool. So I was just curious, you know, based on that like assessment and sort of the idea of, you know, what is the, you know, the best starting point, in my opinion, is still the blade itself. Also, if you bounce off of the audio, do the book. If you bounce off the book, do the audio. And that generally gets most people over the hump one way or another of that first book. And then they love it. So with one exception, Ben's the only one, but he didn't try the audio, I don't believe. So,
okay.
Cool. Not to slander Ben. Love you, Ben. But just speaking to experience of like, would I recommend, you know, would we recommend The Heroes or Best of Cold? Next, I recommended in the group chat that we have Best of Cold, but
yeah,
just to wake him up, a little slap in the face.
I think he'd like it.
I think he would love the whole thing. I think it's just a very contemplative start in many ways from a character perspective, which is not, you know, the same to some degree. So, all right. There are a number of different components in this story that I love to talk about. Obviously, one of the most prominent and omnipresent over top of the whole story is the theme of war, what it means, the conflicts therein. How'd you feel about sort of the way that Joe tackled themes in this bad boy?
I mean, he hit us over the head with them.
Yeah, it's the most present he's ever been.
Yeah, it's been... It was not subtle.
Yeah. Some people were like, oh, what do you mean? And it's like, no, grow up.
But there's so much going on in this in this book with so many different perspectives and overlapping themes from all of them that the hit you over the head sort of aspect of some of it didn't bother me at all.
Yeah. I agree with you. I think the whole conversation around what a straight edge is and what like the right thing is maybe the most interesting conversation to me inside of this book, because we're interrogating both sides of this conflict, of whom some people have been friends for a long time. There are people of whom don't want to be fighting outside of the fact that they're fighting a different name that's the head of the other side. Like Dogman really doesn't like want to fight anyone in the North, but it's the fact that it's Black Dow, the fact that he killed Logan, the fact that all this happened, that it feels like a betrayal in so many ways. So,
and even then, like him hearing that Black Dow is dead, from, is it Gorst's perspective?
Calder. Yeah, it's Calder says it, but it's Gorst's perspective. Yeah.
He mourns it. Like, there's a sadness. Like, there's a clear feeling of that was my friend and now he's gone.
What a, this book nails... And again, I don't think this works like a standalone this way, but this book nails like some of those emotional moments so well that it like it does move me very deeply. But I can't help but imagine, like, if you didn't know that they were friends, would any of that matter to you? You know, like
I think that's intentional.
Their like, friendships,
it's intentionally held back because Gorst doesn't know it.
Yeah, but we know it.
We know it.
We get it.
Is this book written to be picked up as
that's
the first
my
book?
Problem,
I don't
man.
Know.
That's my problem.
It could be. I really think it could be picked up without any prior knowledge to the story. There's a few things that make it better. But if you didn't have that knowledge, I don't think you'd miss it.
It's fair. I can understand. The terror for me would be recommending this to someone in a way that I feel like they would lose some of those elements, because I don't think on reread it's going to become that much stronger as it is when you like initially get hit with some of these emotional moments versus
I'm looking at this is trying to get somebody into the series. Like I think this is a great entrance point to the series if you don't think the person is willing to entertain the blade itself.
All right, PJ.
For whatever reason.
Here's our problem. Here's my pitch. Here's my thing. My dad, we're going to solve this problem right now. My dad is a big science fiction reader. He's not a huge fantasy reader, but he does enjoy sci fantasy and some of those things. I've been trying to get him to read more fantasy. He really enjoyed the Greenbone Saga. It did take him a while to get into. For him, I don't think, despite my own constant advocacy and otherwise, I think he would struggle with the blade itself up until a point. And then I think that it would become great and he would love it.
He's read Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, he's also read all of The Sun Eater. He's read Red Rising. He's like all over a lot of the shit that I love. He's just way more. I mentioned
The Lord of the Rings is specific, like the specific one. Like we've mentioned it as like a comparison in that the trilogy is one book.
Mm-hmm. True. You still have to get the man to commit to reading that many pages, of which he will willingly do because he voraciously consumes things. But
right, fuck man.
The question is, do I throw Best Served Cold at the man? Do I throw the heroes, or do I throw the blade itself, and then like counter adjust if he fails?
I think you give him the option.
When someone fails, like they like lose faith, you know, to some degree in the idea that like they care, so or that they can care.
So I think you give him the stack of three books and say, okay, this is the Lord of the Rings. You give him Best Served Cold and say, this is
the Count of Monte Cristo.
Sure. Or this is a Guy Ritchie movie in novel form. A Guy Ritchie revenge novel.
Which he also loves Guy Ritchie, so that's a good pitch.
I know.
Yeah.
And then you give him, this is the inspiration for Dark Age.
Sure. You say pick.
Yeah. Like,
sure.
The stack of three books, this is the start of all of it. You'll get more out of these two if you read these three first, but technically these are both standalone. Like, you let him pick it.
It's a good
idea. I think those are the way that you, I think that or something similar is how you would frame it.
Sure.
And I think him specifically, it's just dependent on his mood at the time. Because I think he would appreciate all three.
Yeah, no, I think he would.
As they are.
Like,
but I think it just depends on his mood at the time.
Yeah, I'm just using this as an example.
No, I agree.
Right, we're obviously being prescriptive.
In the thought experiment.
Yeah.
I can't help but think there's some truth to it.
I think you're probably right. It's probably a mood pick. He's been going through Sun Eater at a pretty good pace and has been adoring that. And that those are some thick, emotionally thick books, one way or another, and language density. So, you know, maybe there's something there. Maybe you can lead him into the trilogy. But it's something I've genuinely been thinking about for a while, because I, as an introduction to Sanderson, gave him and my stepmom Tress Christmas, I think this last year,
the copy that we got from our
I bought the
really pretty copy
one
that we got, or
but the regular tour one is also very pretty.
I didn't get
them the Dragon Steel, but it's got a great cover. It's my favorite of the, actually Yumi's cover in tour is almost better than the one we got, but that's separate.
Who liked Yumi's cover?
I fucking the one that love we got. Yumi's cover. No, I love it. I'm just saying that there's like a painterly style to the tour one that I really appreciate as well.
Okay.
Like, it's actually much more similar to the art that's within the Yumi book than the cover is, because the cover feels a little bit separated, if that makes sense. It's great. I love them both. But the tour Yumi cover is great. So
okay.
Regardless, I gave them that book and they both bounced off of it. So it's like oh, all fuck. Right. It's The Princess Bride. What do you mean? So
that's all right.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure shit out. Although I think Deb bounced off of it for completely different reasons. I think it was mostly work, but neither here nor there. Okay. So we've gotten the idea of recommendations out of the way, which is a big part of where my brain went with this episode and talking about some of those things. I wanted to mention, or at the very least pitch to you, characters that you think that you'd miss the most or that you're going to miss the most going forward that were introduced in this novel, maybe lost, or that were introduced previously that were lost, characters you're looking forward to, maybe seeing more of.
Beck.
Beck. Okay.
I mean, no.
That you'll miss the most, or that you're looking forward to. Just clarify, miss the most or looking forward to?
I'm thinking miss the most. Sure. And I think I'm talking myself out of that because I really love, I think I'd be upset with him coming back. Sure. Because I think his entire arc is self-contained.
Mm-hmm.
The hero's journey and the return. I am so perfectly content. I don't want more from Beck. I have done a 180.
You changed your opinion.
I don't want more of him. Like I think I'll be upset if I see more of Beck.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think his arc just works so well as it is. Craw, we've talked about like loving Craw as a character, but I'm looking forward to seeing where Wonderful is.
Mm. Okay. Cool.
Yeah. I think.
Does she rise? Does she fall?
She rose to the second.
In the north. Yeah.
In the north. What sort of position does she hold in Calder's army? Or Scales, technically, now?
Yeah. Calder's just a war chief.
Yeah. Exactly. But
just in quotes,
she was at like for a brief moment the second most powerful person in the north.
Mm-hmm.
And where has she fallen to any sort of specific position? I think technically she like by virtue of both Scale and Calder being alive, she has to have fallen in like rank, mm-hmm. but who knows? I'm curious about that more than anything. Shivers, of course.
Yeah, I mean, Shivers is...
That's a given.
We'll talk about Shivers isolated yeah, from this. I want to talk about Shivers specifically through this book and otherwise.
I'm going to miss Tunny.
An interesting comparison. Tunny? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think we'll see Tunny again?
I think we'll hear
or
about Tunny.
Or, you know.
Yeah, I think tangentially we'll get a little Easter egg of them, but I don't see us spending any intimate time with them. But
sure.
Sorry to I move forward while you were
No. I did want to mention just Wonderful at the very least. Do you feel like Wonderful hitting that level and also like the North's acceptance of women maybe changes to some degree because of Wonderful or otherwise? Like, Wonderful is the only woman warrior Northman that we've experienced in the story thus far. Not that they don't exist otherwise, but
it's an oddity.
What do you think about women's place in the North?
And everyone refers to it as an oddity. But it's not
Three
like
Trees, though, also being progressive and accepting. Giving them more credit, even.
For sure. And it never really comes across as like controversial.
No.
Just that it's strange.
Different. Yeah.
It's just different. So I'm curious because like nobody dismisses her for being a woman.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I can recall. And maybe it's just that she's established well enough. Yeah, I don't know what to make of that. Because, like, clearly, it is an uphill battle that she's faced to be taken seriously as a woman in the army. But at the same time, we haven't been exposed to any sort of discrimination.
Right. For that reason. There's no counter, for the most part, outside of some, like, general very vague, like sexism, but that's mostly about like people just wanting to like sleep with women or whores or whatever the hell else. So,
right. Women or whores, as Crossland points out.
Well, there's a difference. I was going to say, though, I think that you're so, I didn't mean that. I meant, okay, hang on. I didn't mean there's a difference between those two things. I did want to say that I think that there's a
distinction.
A distinction that the book makes. I think that the book makes, even from the series on the whole, none of the rest of the series deals with sexual violence in any kind of serious way, intentionally. Right. It, like, there is the threat of rape early on, that, like, in before they're hanged, that, like, West intervenes in the middle of. But otherwise, compared to, like, something like Game of Thrones or, like, a lot of other grimdark series, in quotes, Joe doesn't do that so much. And that puts us in an interesting place within this story, because Finry does kind of come under what she feels like is that threat, and also what, not Pale as Snow, Stranger Come Knocking sort of meets out conversationally about what will happen to Brent's wife, Elise. And that leaves us in an interesting spot in the story. And so I only bring this up in this context because it's interesting to me that this is the turn, but also war is such a cruel thing that to leave it out as a thing that didn't happen in the past, as though these weren't prizes that were sought, would feel incorrect from, like, an anthropological perspective. But yeah, I don't know. What are your feelings? I feel like this is just so out there in that direction, but also not aggressive in our face like some others.
Yeah, the implication of it all is there.
Mm-hmm.
But I appreciated the assumption of hardship that Wonderful had to overcome without the, mm-hmm. like, without the overwhelming explicit description of it,
you know. Yeah, it's all there in the backdrop, right? It's assumed to some degree. And I also think that's why Finry's guilt is so assumed when we're in her perspective, is every time she thinks about Elise, every right. time she's doing any negotiation, right, for the rest of the book, she's fighting for that woman's life.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a damn tragedy as well,
right?
Because, okay, we were kind of, and I did this intentionally because that's the way that I have to do these things. I was kind of shit posting on Elise, being like, oh, she's kind of dumb and she's kind of haha and she's kind of like whatever. And then, you know, the brutal moment happens and the turn happens and there's this, like, dire hope that maybe she can get her out and never does. And that's just sad for the Brints on the whole. Yeah.
Yeah, it's tough.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, definitely want to talk more in a different direction here. Okay, so we've spent our time talking a little bit here about women in the story, and I think it's important that we go to our number one incel, or, you know, union quiet squeaky boy. Not our boy, but the quiet union squeaky boy.
I don't know what you're talking about. He's truly a feminist.
Truly, he would certainly classify himself as one in his own internal monologue.
I don't think he would.
Well, actually, you're probably right. He probably wouldn't. Gorse is such a unique perspective in terms of the rest of this novel. How did you feel about Gorse?
He was simultaneously repulsive and captivating.
Yeah, of course.
God, the writings and the revelations of his personal life and things that he did with and for the king.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely disgusting. Really, yeah. Really gross.
And also, just generally, the way that man's is, you know, like the way that he be, he's pretty bad. I personally really enjoy Gorse as a character. But he is one of those characters that is despicable. And, you know, you have to acknowledge that simultaneously.
Yeah. You concede that pretty quickly in the story. Mm-hmm. And then you love him anyway.
Yeah, he's such a weirdly likable character because of how... Or, like, a difficult character to grapple with to some degree because of how, like, internally honest he is, which is such a unique thing.
He's internally honest, and also you feel bad for him because his flaws and the things that he attributes his sort of social outcastedness to mm-hmm. are outwardly relatable.
Yeah.
And, like, you believe hook, line, and sinker that, like, that's the whole reason why he's on the outs. Like, his high, squeaky voice and his, like, shy nature and things like that. And no, that's not the whole truth.
The reality is so much further than the truth because
right.
he views it that way, but that isn't the way it actually is. Because if he was himself as a person, he would have been accepted much earlier. He would have been rejected. Like, the rejection that he has at the end of this novel with Finry as he approaches her with the, like, sort of I love you moment and whatever else out loud is one in which, I mean, we've used the term, I'll use it again. It's very incel in its own right, but it is more like a 15-year-old's emotional reaction to a woman, to a girl, than it is like an adult, mature person.
Right.
And there's this conflict within him as a person where his emotional maturity doesn't match his relationship emotional maturity, doesn't match like his actual physical prowess and maturity and like progression in that direction, as well as just sort of this failure of a man. I don't know. It's tough. He's a tough character to parse.
It's true. I feel like there was so much work done for, like, and for good reason, for comedic bits, but also for kind of a smokescreen to point to his high, squeaky voice and make us assume that that is the reason why he is constantly being judged.
Mm-hmm.
And that is executed so well from the beginning, from the first series, from our first interaction with Gorst, we get this person that is never going to fit in with society.
Mm-hmm. From his impressions, though.
No, that's, even before, even during The Blade itself.
No, I know.
He is always presented as somebody who does not have the characteristics of somebody who fits in with society. So, when we're presented with him being ousted from society,
mm-hmm.
we're primed to assume that it's at the very least because of his qualities.
Sure.
As a person.
Yep.
And he leans into it too.
Mm-hmm.
Constantly. Rags on himself for it. And we have no reason to doubt that because it's always been the case. Even before he was a perspective. Because it's always been the case before he was a perspective. So to, mm-hmm. to have that reveal at the end of this, that it has nothing to do with his high, squeaky voice. It has nothing to do
with Finnery,
with his shyness and his ineptitude towards social interactions in general and with women specifically, that makes it hit so much harder.
It really does. And I think that this is also sent home to some degree by the perspectives that we get generally from the other people, right? So I think it's chain of command in which we see, I think, almost the most reflection on Gorst as a character externally, as people comment on his high voice, mostly being surprised by it. Almost no one is diminutive about that, though. Like, they're never like talking down about him for the high voice, just that they're shocked or surprised by it. And yeah. So I think it's interesting that everyone is like, it's built in him, that surprise is built in him, this like negative reaction so deeply, but it's not. It's just shock.
Yeah. There's shock. To our point before, talking about Wonderful, there's a lot of commentary about it being a womanly voice, but like that in and of itself is not an insult
or an indictment. Yeah, either way,
or anything like that. That's it. It's just matter of fact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's the thing that bums me out the most, is that there's so much potential for him to just be the human, the person that he is, but because of his own impression of himself, of which I think he partially pins on his father, which seems to maybe be mostly accurate.
That, I mean, it's so just relatable though, man.
It for sure
to,
is.
To have
it is very relatable.
To have something that you don't like about yourself and to focus on that.
I definitely like
this
agree.
Takes it to an extreme for sure.
Yeah.
But like, you notice your own flaws way more than anybody else takes notice of them. And even when other people notice them, they don't remember it. Just generally, yeah. Like that, as far as general sort of advice goes, if you display something that you don't like, you're going to be the most likely to remember that.
Right. Yeah.
Anybody that's going to
leave the biggest imprint on. You may have fucked up, you know, in some realm or in some like social conversation or whatever. That's going to live way harder in your head than it does anyone else. And Gorst is such an indication, I would say, of an almost average person's perspective, but with an extreme lens into it. Like, this is way more clarity than we get into any other character in the series thus far, but for also sure. Just in general, it's the closest that we've ever been to someone's mind. Glockta gets close-ish, but I think that he's still removed enough because he's so self-aware and so self-good, you know, that Gorst like rivals that.
Yeah. I think so.
Yeah. Ugh, what a character. I particularly appreciated your thoughts on like will he join the North and everything else like that. I think it was fun to kind of get to go through those segments. He's an incredible fighter, of course, and truly a menace. I mean, throughout the combat scenes in this book. Yeah. One of the complaints, speaking of this novel, that people occasionally levy is that there isn't enough fighting for a book that's supposed to be a war novel, and that there's too much thinking and talking. And I'm like, I disagree
with that entirely.
But I do think that I could use 20% more talking than what's here. Like, again, I want this book to be longer in many ways.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I agree with that. I think we get enough fighting, but I would like more preamble.
I know. I need a little bit more of the characters to like make some things worth it here and there, but just reflecting on that thought. Okay,
yeah.
The other character that we kind of skipped over to some degree is Calder, the other primary POV. So with Black Calder in mind, how do you feel about his point of view? He's in a very different situation. He's boisterous. He's reflecting on his failures.
Man, yeah. I
said Craw earlier. Calder is my favorite point of view.
Really? Okay.
I disagree with myself now.
I disagree with you.
Sure.
There's a lot that I like about Calder and his perspective, but I feel like it's either inconsistent or he's just not the family man that he makes himself out to be, because there is so much
family man. Yeah. I think it's the latter.
I believe that, but I want,
he's supposed
I want
to
recompense for that failure to, or for that, not failure, he has his cake and he eats it too, to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
In this story of being the family man and being the family man on paper and not living that life and then still reaping the benefits for it in the end, if that makes sense.
I do think I agree with you in some sense. I do think that he is objectionable from a lot of perspectives, especially as you consider the way that he like even talks to his wife about like, you know, like sleeping with whores and otherwise as like a bit, you know, I'll always come back to you or whatever. And he thinks about like loving her specifically very early on in such a different context. But I do think what's interesting is I think that Calder is one of the few characters that we have in the entire series, similar to Finry or Beck, that does genuinely experience a lasting change. And I do think when Scale comes back, he does meaningfully experience the fact that he cannot kill his brother and could never wish that upon him. He was willing to take advantage and benefit from his death when it wasn't at his own hands, and he's more than willing to kill someone for advantage, as we see over the course of the rest of this book and before, but he is unwilling to do that to his own flesh and blood.
Actual
flesh and blood.
I'm of a couple minds for this.
Sure.
One is that read on this.
Which is outward. The right one. We love that. We love that you're starting with that. I'm just kidding.
The other is that he sees this as an out for being under the thumb of Baez.
Which is also a good cause that I think also overlaps. I would say that both is likely, but I do think that there's a little bit of a family bend there. Like, those are compounding factors, I would say.
Okay. That's a secondary sort of factor to it, but
yeah.
I could see it being a primary factor. That's part of the reason why I don't think Calder's perspective is one of my favorites, is that there is so much to Calder's perspective that we are still kept in the dark for a lot of it. And that's fine. That's okay. But compared to all of the other perspectives, we don't get the inner monologue of Calder very much.
Quite as much, yeah. Calder is much more of an unreliable narrator in a very, like, Polonic way. Like, he is... And that is also, in and of itself, can or could be very abrasive to, like, a listener or a reader coming into this, I think, because everyone else is so reliable, so direct, so immediate. And Calder is afraid, scared, but playing political games. We're going to talk a little bit more about Red Rising in a moment here. But I do think that there are touches here that are reminiscent of things that I didn't like in Morningstar that I do think that Joe does better from, like, Calder lying to us through his perspective. And it's third person versus first person, so that's an important differential to begin with. But I do think that one of the maybe problems that I can point to with this book is the idea of reliable versus unreliable narrators based on the point of view, which generally when you're taking in a story, you either know from the beginning whether or not it's a reliable or an unreliable narrator, and you take all of the information under the guise of whether or not, like, you should interpret it weirdly. So
yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But he's wishy-washy enough where it is a question of where he feels and how he feels. I find that complex and interesting, but it is, I think, difficult to grapple with, and it is unclear, I would say. There are very few concrete answers with Calder. I find that to be the most attractive part of the novel, though.
It is fun.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't say I have any sort of problem with Calder's perspective. I just don't find it to be one of my favorites as a result.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense to me. Okay. Moving from Calder, then, I want to make mention of Shivers. We'll talk about some of the side characters that we kind of missed here. Shivers, Baez, Ishri, sort of the lineup, the murderer's row of connective tissue for the sign-up, or for the standalones and otherwise here. So, Shivers. How'd you feel about Shivers' inclusion in this book? And his characterization post-Sapani, post-losing his eye, post-Styria?
I mean, Shivers is the reason why I feel like these two books belong together.
Yeah.
And belong in the series the way that they do. There's a few points here and there where Sapani and where Styria is directly referenced.
Mm-hmm.
But even without that reference,
you can get the gist.
Yeah. You get the gist, but mm-hmm. I think you get so much more out of Shivers, this book,
like perspective. Yeah, I don't mean that from a POV.
Like, I'd be really, really curious to hear somebody's thoughts on this if they read this book before Best Served Cold. Like, I know we had this conversation before about like recommendations Shivers, and things.
Though. Yeah.
But Shivers specifically changes my tune on that, because this feels like his sequel in a lot of ways.
The standalones are often occasionally referred to by two different titles. The one that I've told you and talked about way more actively is The Great Leveler. The second one, of which I've squeaked in every once in a while, kind of on accident, is the Shivers trilogy, in part because of how big of a part he plays as sort of the connective tissue between these novels, and even to the original series, if you think about it. In my opinion, I think Shivers is the main character of the story, right there with Baez. And he is so critical from the moment that he's introduced and before they're hanged, as sort of a minor character, to growing throughout these couple of novels, that I view him personally as my central character for the first six books, at least.
Interesting.
Yeah. But that said, he's mostly like a minor character in the first two, or rather in Before They're Hanged, Last Argument of Kings, comes to fruition throughout the weight of Best Served Cold. And then, you know, we kind of live with him to some degree through the other books. So, yeah, of which we'll see more in Red Country. So, yeah, Shivers as a weighty character, and the reflection upon his eye and sort of the loss therein, his like reflection on mercy and cowardice and all these other components are wonderful in their own right as he's grown as a man and as he reflects on sort of the nature of war, battle, and conflict, I think in particular are so poignant compared to the experience that so many other people have had. So,
agreed.
Yeah. He's good. Shivers rules.
Know who doesn't rule so much?
Who doesn't?
Baez.
Yeah, Baez. There's our boy. Not our boy. There's our fucking ghastly, incomprehensible demon of a man. Talk to me about your feelings about Baez in this book.
It's
Infernal Contraptions. The work with the university, gunpowder as a concept.
The craziest part about Baez in this book is that he doesn't seem such a bad guy at face value.
That's Baez consistently, though, isn't it? Isn't
that the problem? No, I know, and that's the thing, is that he only feels like such a bad guy because we understand the true depth of his connection to everything.
Yeah. Outside of his conversation with Calder forcing him to see the dead. But yeah,
I mean, there's I totally that.
Agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I think that like Baez in this novel plays such an interesting counterpoint to Finry's place, right, and the Brox and sort of everything there, that there's this thing to aspire to that they can like politically make moves against, while simultaneously for all of us of whom experienced the previous books, we're like, what the fuck are you doing here, bro? Like, what is actually the goal? Like, they're right. We're so suspicious immediately of the intent.
Yeah. Like, there's maybe no that's fucking way. Where
the story could be better, is Baez is more of a mystery, but...
Maybe. I that's another thing I'd be curious of a first-time reader. Either of... Like, even if they start with Bester of Cold.
Bester of Cold doesn't say Baez's name.
At all. Yeah.
Outside of the first of the Magi, I think a couple of times, but like otherwise is very particular about my master when Sulfur shows up. But
yeah, but you would get that this was Sulfur.
You don't really know the Sulfur thing until I think the end of book one, close to book two.
No, but, no. Between yeah. Bester, like you. If you didn't start
with... Oh, the servant. Sure. If you're just reading standalone, sorry. I was like looking backwards from those points.
Yeah. If you were just reading the standalones, I think whatever order you read them in, I think you'd get it well enough.
Yeah, fair. Cool. Yeah, Baez is a terrifying figure in the story. I think this is also the most page time that we have with him since last argument. You know, like, he is so deeply involved in so much of the story. We had so many lines and so many conversations, and I think he's so much more intimidating here in some ways, although Finry is more heroic than any character we've ever seen confront him simultaneously, which I think also presses upon the idea of what his limits are, one way or another. So,
yeah,
tough to say.
I think so,
specifically.
Too.
Yeah. Okay. To round out some of the character conversations, we should obviously talk about Ishri. I would be remiss if we didn't talk about Wirin. Wirin Ablai is one of my favorite Joe Abercrombie characters, period. He's so funny. He's brilliantly written. He's got this tone. Stephen Pacey delivers him excellently. Ugh, I'll miss that man the most of the characters that I will miss from this story.
Yeah, hard not to.
Yeah.
It'd be really, really difficult to pick anybody other than Warren for
who would I miss the most. Obviously wonderful. Yeah. Jolyon's fun.
Fun. None of them.
I mean, Jalen.
I wouldn't pick any of them over.
He's dead.
Yeah. Warren.
I don't know. I'd put Jalen Horn pretty close there with Warren, but like. That's
would you
because
would you really
because we have more history though with Jalen Horn. I think that like he builds
I
up
don't
like this,
give a shit about my history with Jalen Horn.
That's so it I'd so interesting
I'd so I, much more rather spend more time with Wirin.
I agree with you on that front. Like Wirin gets the preference 100% just because of this book, but I feel like Jalen Horn was the least deserving of his end of any of the drinking mates that we've seen thus far.
Yeah, so that can be true.
It just feels like and I can agree with and, like, that. You deserve but, like, more time.
I don't. I who do I want to spend more time with? There's no contest that it's Wirin.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. I guess my point was is that if I had to put like a label on like a top two, I'm definitely putting Wirin and then Jalen Horn.
I don't think I'd even put Jalen Horn.
Because
in the top five, Jalen, and I can't even fill out the other four. I don't know.
Oh my like, God.
Jalen Horn, like he is a great character and like the history is great, but I do not care about him that much.
He's emblematic
other than
of
the fact
like being
that
a hero.
He's other than the fact that he's an undeserving general. Like
It's not just the fact that
he's not that interesting
general.
To me.
Oh, I disagree. I think that Jalen Horn is a fascinating look upon like the failure of this sort of like nepotistic system. But I do think on the other side of that, even in just the peeks we get behind the curtain from Gorst and that conversation, that is one of my favorite moments in the whole book. That's why we talked about it for so fucking long during that episode, in which you may not have cared nearly as much. But like, I adore the conversation that happens between Gorst and Jalen Horn because it is finally an exposition of who he is, why he was here, why he did this in the first place. And we got some of that in notes in the past with through the blade itself in particular, because the blade itself really focuses in, if we talk about the drinking buddies, on Jelenhorm and Brint as characters. And Jelenhorm is this guy of whom has this sort of like hero's rise to him. And then he does become elevated through Before They're Hanged and occupies kind of the similar space of like just in the background. But like he sees the impropriety of the system. He sees the failure. He hopes to build upon it. He's hoping to do more. West kind of like just kind of shoves him out of the way, is like, you're going to do the right thing because I told you to. And Jelenhorm is like, I don't know if that's the right call. And he always wants to be the better man. And so then in the end, in this book, he gets to choose to be the better man. And so that's why I miss Jelenhorm the most. Jelenhorm is the character that I, the side character, I should say, that I think is my favorite in this whole damn book. And because of that arc, but it's a five book arc. I cannot, four book arc, because he's not in Best Circle, but like, I can't take it in isolation. I don't think anyone would give a shit if you didn't have anything else. He is just like a nobody burger. But in reread in particular, he was the character for me that hit the hardest of them all, because all of the depth of meaning of all of the actions that he's taken to get to this point, including his failures as a leader and including like the utter mess of a man that he is before Gorst. But yeah, I don't know.
I believe it.
Resonate a lot with Jelenhorm, especially in this reread.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Wirin, though, is the coolest character on page in this book. And that was my counterpoint to what you were saying. Like, Wirin's the best character that is just in this book, like just from a page to page perspective. We get more time with Wirin in the near future. It is a flashback, but you know, we get a short story.
Interesting
that. Yeah.
Looking forward to that.
He's in Sharpens. Lots of flashbacks in Sharpens. So cool. Ishri and Kalul, sort of the mystery of the South. Think we're going anywhere there?
Of course we're going somewhere there. God, that constant battle between Baez and Kalul. It's really hard to parse what is actual peace and what is pageantry. I don't know.
Yeah. Do you think Ishri, what do you think of Ishri at this point after two books of seeing her as sort of this sort of spy agent and otherwise? I think the most direct line we've had to Kalul for sure, representation or otherwise. I like Ishri a lot as a character.
I like her too. I think she's even closer to Kalul than she presents herself as being.
Sure.
And that, like, that meaning, I think that her actions and her decisions are much more in line with the actions and decisions of Kalul.
Sure.
Than just a like couple tiers down prophet. Or not prophet. Prophet would be a specific term.
You know, among the hundred words, although most of the hundred words are dead. She's the wind, one of the winds, which as stated, were kind of like a kind of
she's vaguely, the east wind, correct?
Yes. Yeah, she's the east wind. I kind of made this assertion when we were reading the original trilogy, which didn't have a whole lot of base until you kind of get to this point of like knowing Ishri. But I kind of view the winds as characters, as the Nazgul equivalent in quotes, like they're commanders externally, but you know, unclear if and to what degree they're similar.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. I want to give a quick cheers to Black Dow, because rip the buddy. We talked a lot about him in our final episode of this, and if you haven't listened to that, definitely go give it back. Listen, but Black Dow, deservedly.
Cheers, Black Dow. I think he deserves it.
Yeah. A great and interesting character.
He, man, it's so interesting. He is a brash character from the start, but... Mm-hmm. It is a feat to hold any amount of like land for any amount of time. And he held the entirety of the North for at least 8 years. Longer than Bethon.
Way more than
did.
Bethon. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, despite our understanding of how he came to power, he rules the North really efficiently and really well.
He clearly did. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a sort of brutal realization to go like, oh, of the people that we know that have ruled the North, it's Black Dao that ruled it the longest. You know, yeah. Like that's such a crazy, crazy thought.
We've got Scarling Hoodless.
Mm-hmm.
We've got Bethod.
Yep.
Logan, technically. I feel like there's one other that was mentioned.
There was a different Uniter, but he wasn't huge. He didn't do the whole thing, but yeah.
I mean, Logan can be counted in number of pages.
Yeah.
Bethod,
at best.
Bethod is like the longest, and he's attributed with uniting the North. And it was like 3 years. So by assumption, everyone else is less than that.
Yeah. And Dao just is reigning well above. So
he just kills it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I do think I still ask the question at the end of all this of if we think Black Dao's reputation was genuine or something that was foisted upon him based on things that he was around. And I don't know to this day.
I don't think he actively killed and cut and burned people the way that he leans into it. Like,
mm-hmm.
He only ever uses it as a threat.
Yeah.
And there are examples of people being cut and burned and hanged, but it's always kind of in Dao's name, not really like by Dao.
Mm-hmm. It's a reputational thing, which is what he also maintains the entirety of this book with Craw. You know?
And that is the truth of the names that all Northmen get.
Right.
They named men get named by circumstances and
an inappropriate mismatch in many ways.
Yeah, an overreading of a situation or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
Beck knows that all too well.
Red Beck. Yeah.
And it's just a matter of marketing when it comes to taking that name and making something else out of it.
Totally. I get that. So, cheers again to Black Dao. Love the man. He was great. Then he died. Now we're here.
Now we're here.
What a lovely character. Before we go in to our Dark Age comparisons and Red Rising spoiler conversation within this episode, is there anything else that you wanted to chat about? Anything more on Beck? Because I know we kind of talked about him early, but
man, it just feels so, it feels so out of place to have a too good to be true character arc.
Yeah.
Like we get out of Beck. Like Beck experiences some fucking trauma for sure.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
But I can't think of any other quote unquote good endings that any of our characters get.
No. Yeah. None of them. Maybe friendly, because like he just wants to count.
Kind
but, like,
of,
that's
but
not
his,
good.
His, yeah. His story is still not done. Maybe Artie?
Artie? Sure. Positive versus where she ended. Yeah.
That's it. Started, that's rather. All I can think of.
Yeah. But Beck's the only POV at the very least for the most part that like,
yeah,
we see the end of that feels like it resolves in a complete way.
Right.
Yeah. Everyone else lives on in some context. Cool. Anything else that you want to bring up on the heroes?
Not that I can think of.
Cool. I wanted to talk about, now we'll break for just, we're not breaking, you know, for us, but like just to give you guys a second, we're going to talk about some Red Rising spoilers here, just in relation to Dark Age specifically. It may verge into any of the books beforehand, but for the most part, this is to reflect on something that I've long talked about from Pierce Brown's perspective. So if you haven't listened to Dark Age, we are done talking about the heroes for the rest of this. We're going to do a little wrap-up segment at the end, as we usually do, talking about what we're going to read next. If you want to know, you can check out the website, or you can check out the end of the episode.
Cool.
Cool. With that out of the way, Dark Age, right? Dark Age is this crazy book that is mostly a battle scene.
It's a war novel.
For the first 300 pages. Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you make of the comparison? What do you make of Pierce's inspiration? God,
it makes so much sense.
Yeah.
It feels so similar. And I would say Dark Age gets more into the nitty-gritty of it all.
Yeah. It's much more battle-focused as opposed to people-focused. It also is a book in a series as opposed to a standalone.
And it's also less of a... Like, this is an entire war, mm-hmm. more or less, across several days. Whereas Dark Age is... Across several days, but it's like
a week,
single
week and
battle.
And a half. Yeah. Yeah.
Within the war at a larger scale. So like the comparisons make a lot of sense, but like it is one battle within a larger war versus one war that is only a couple really hard fought battles.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think by comparison as well, you know, one of the things that Pierce does, I think, a little bit better than Joe does, and this is just maybe even a general note, is Joe is, as Lord Grimdark, is more hopeless in general, although we still see light within our characters. Pierce gives us hope in the form of, like, Alexander and, you know, like, some of the other characters that we see from their perspectives from the battlefront. But then tears it the fuck away from us between the like waterfall and like losing Alexander once, and then he comes back and he's saved, and then, you know, Lysander breaks him out, and then later Lysander shoots him in the face, and there's like all this like sort of sad notes that happen that actually make Dark Age, in my opinion, cut deeper on an emotional level. But I don't think it ever rises to the victory that the Heroes has as a war novel, if that makes sense, which feels like that's what it was seeking, but doesn't accomplish.
Okay.
I've been waiting for a long time to talk about this. So it's like a weird, you know, weird kind of confluence of things, but.
I can understand where you're coming from. Man, I still see it as a war novel, though.
I mean, it is. I'm not disagreeing that it's not a war novel. I'm just saying that, like, I don't think that they hit the same levels in a lot of ways, or they're like, while Dark Age is very inspired by the Heroes and he cites it as like the primary inspiration, I see comparisons from the war novel level and from those 200 ish pages that I think are very much driven by those comparisons. But I do think that the character work in the Heroes outshines the character work in Dark Age. I think that Dark Age is so focused on like plot and driving us forward through all these dark things that I think the Heroes instead gives us nuance into the balance of war and into the balance of fate and reality and the way that like we think about what we're doing from a violence perspective and reflecting on, like, to me, Dark Age feels like, for 200 pages, and this isn't really that big of a complaint, but it feels like the Gorst war chapters for 200 pages. And what I think Dark Age needed was more Beck, you know?
Yeah.
Or like more from Lysander or otherwise, someone else. It could have been anyone. It could have been a new POV, but.
Yeah, anyway. I agree with you there for sure.
Yeah. It's just my own note. Cool. All right, man. Well, Anything else?
I don't think so.
Cool. It's been a long evening.
Yes.
We're gonna keep our outro-ish short here. If you want to leave us a review, you can do so on any of the platforms of your choice. I found out this weekend while doing a little bit of various podcast cleanup, but otherwise, we're well-reviewed on Stitcher and Pandora, so thank you guys so much for leaving us reviews there. I found that we had almost 100 reviews on that platform as well, so glad that we have so many listeners spread across everything. We're trying to update, and if you can't find us on your platform of choosing and you're listening to us on something else, send us an email, wordsandwhiskeyshow@gmail.com. Beyond that, we are also now on Blue Sky under a slightly updated address. You can find us under the old one as well, but we are now wordsandwhiskey.show, just like our email address or our website address is. So it matches identically. It's the new verification system for all those things. So very excited.
Perfect.
Yeah. Beyond that, again, like I mentioned earlier with the reviews, leave us a 5-star review if you can. Oh, and we should talk about what we're reading next week. PJ, we'll be talking about this more in the future, probably in the beginning of next episode. We are going to be tackling the rest of the First Law at a heavily expedited pace.
Correct.
As a part of that, we're basically breaking up every book into just 2 episodes going forward. I think I might have an argument to make a third out of Trouble with Peace, just because it's the second or third longest book in the series. But for the time being, 2 episodes apiece. So we're going to be doing Red Country from the beginning of the book through the chapter Sleeping Partner, which is in the middle of the third part of the novel.
Middle of part 3.
Yeah, right before Fun, which is the other chapter. So,
yeah.
All right, cool. But with that in mind, we're so excited to cover the rest of the series and to kind of finish it out, sharp ends and everything included. It's going to be a sad end, but I'm excited that we get to finish it. So,
me too, for sure.
Cool. All right.
Hey, everyone. PJ here once again. I just want to make a little bit of an announcement for those of you who didn't see this on either our Patreon or our Instagram feed. After the conclusion of the First Law series, I am going to be stepping away from the podcast altogether. I'm going to be stepping away as a primary host of the show. Don't worry, we do have another person lined up. Awesome, awesome host. Going to be great episodes coming for you for the future series with Crossland as well. But with the changes that have come to my life, I just do not have the necessary time to commit to this show like it deserves, between the amount of reading and note taking and recording that needs to be done. It's just a little bit too much of a time commitment for me right now, but I will plan on coming back for some short pour episodes and some one-off episodes, and I'll be around here and there. I'm still going to stick around in the Patreon Discord, following along with the show, reading along with the show, and putting my thoughts into words there. But yeah, unfortunately, I just need to step away, so I am going to miss you all. This has been such an amazing journey. We've been doing this for 5 years. We've gone over 250 episodes. We've covered so many great, amazing series, and I have become a very different reader than I was at the start of all this. And Crossland is 100% who I have to thank for that. He totally achieved his goal of turning me into a reader, and I am very, very happy to be joining all of you on the flip side of this recording. So thank you all so much for listening and for supporting us. And we wouldn't have continued to do it without all of you listening. And I'm so glad that you did, because I've really, really enjoyed this. Love you all. Thanks.